Well, it seems that on a fairly regular basis in the news, we have stories of people who have done things clearly against their own best interest. In some cases, these are people who were already celebrities, so no matter what they do, that's news. But in other cases, they're people who are not well-known, and they have become well-known merely for doing something that seems to the rest of us spectacularly stupid. And the question is that we ask ourselves when we hear these stories is why? Why do people do things so clearly against their best interest? That is the question that we will discuss this morning in this part of the show. And our guest is John Portman. He says this is a question that has interested him too, and he thought about it enough to write a book, which is titled Bad for Us, The Lure of Self-Harm. It's published by the Beacon Press. It's out there in the bookstore. He is a professor at University of Virginia. He's assistant professor of religious studies. He's the author of some other books. His most recent is titled When Bad Things Happen to Other People, which looks at why it is that so often we seem to take pleasure in the misfortune of others. That book's out there, too, if you'd like to read it. As we talk, questions are certainly welcome. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois, Indiana, wherever the signal will travel. Even if you're listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. So at any point here, you can join us. The only thing we ask of people who call in is that they are brief, just so we can make room for as many different people as possible. But anyone's welcome to call. Well, Professor Portman, hello.
Hello. Please call me John.
All right. Well, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
In the book here, in the preface, you write that the fact that so many people do what's bad for them fascinates you. Why? Why does that fascinate you?
Well, for the reason that you just pointed to in your very good introduction, we in America are very competitive people, and I think that oftentimes, when we stop and think about what we as a group of people are like, we think of ourselves as being very, very competitive. We want a better job than the people around us. We want to drive a fancier car. We want to live in a bigger house. And generally speaking, I think that's actually a pretty good characterization of we Americans. And yet, there are so many ways in which we hurt ourselves intentionally. That interests me. What interests me even more is why other people will tell us we're hurting ourselves when we claim to be doing something that we enjoy. Lots of examples spring to mind, and if you'll indulge me for a second, I'll just run through three that literally just occurred to me. Mm-hmm. A couple of years ago, I followed with great interest something that happened in Illinois. The governor was leaving, and there was a lot of talk about death sentences, something very unusual, but I think actually quite understandable had happened in Illinois prisons. Some men who were serving life sentences said, look, I'm just going to stop eating. I'm going to starve myself. Life in prison is hellish. And I don't want to go through another 30, 40, maybe 50 years of this. I'd rather be dead than living in this tiny cell. And so I'm going to go on a hunger strike. I'm just going to kill myself. I'm going to stop eating. It's my body. I can do what I want. Well, what did Illinois say? No way. We will force feed you if you stop eating. We will not allow you to die. We're going to make you live so you can complete this life sentence. I found that fascinating. Not long after that, in Wisconsin, a case reached the state legislature that also fascinated me. It turns out that teenagers and 20-somethings in Wisconsin started surgically splitting their tongues. They wanted to look like snakes. And although I know nothing more about this than what I've read in the media, apparently human beings can live just fine if they split their tongues in two. Apparently chewing is a little awkward, but you can live. That is fine. Well, the good people of Wisconsin felt deeply uncomfortable with the idea that some people in their midst were surgically splitting their tongues. And so it was decided that this should be illegal. This as well fascinates me. Why can't we split our tongues if we want to? I personally have absolutely no desire whatsoever to split my tongue, but I'm curious why I wouldn't be allowed to do that if I wanted to. We might think of transsexuals as well in the 50s and 60s. And to a certain extent, even today, I think a lot of Americans came to feel very, very uncomfortable that a woman would change her genitals or that a man would do the same thing. I couldn't help but hear in your introduction that you're talking about same-sex marriage tomorrow. This topic, which to a certain extent really divides Americans right now, also centrally includes this question of why we can't do to or with ourselves whatever we like. In the course of thinking about this question of what we can and can't do to or with ourselves, I started looking around. That's what researchers do. And I found a lot written on what we're not allowed to do with other people or to other people. We're not allowed to rob them, say, for example, or throw acid on them or murder them or rob them, et cetera, et cetera. But very, very little written on what we're not allowed to do to or with ourselves until I got to Kant. Kant is Immanuel Kant, who dies in 1804, is widely considered the most influential of all modern moral philosophers, perhaps the most influential moral philosopher of all time. And Kant, toward the end of his life, does turn to the question of what we may not do to or with ourselves, and he's very helpful. And interestingly enough, he comes up with a list of 10 things, 10 kinds of people that we should never allow ourselves to become. It's kind of like a David Letterman list. And interestingly enough, the very worst of the 10 things that includes on his list at the end of the 18th century is gay sex, homosexual activity. Now, Kant really, unfortunately, never talks or thinks very much about women. His focus is really on men, and in that regard, he wasn't at all unusual. It wasn't really until quite recently that philosophers started thinking about women as moral agents. But in Kant's thinking, it was simply revolting for a man to engage in sexual activity with another man. This was an instance of something that a person should never, ever do to himself. And I found this fascinating as well. The mere fact that we as a culture are so divided over same-sex marriage means that at least some people think that women who have sex with women or men who have sex with men have every right to use their bodies in this way. That said, I think that a significant segment of the American populace would still agree with Kant and would say that this is simply revolting. So I find that the entire question, I could go on for an hour, but I know you don't want me to. I find this entire question of why we can't do what we claim to want to do fascinating, and how it is that other people tell us that we're harming ourselves when we don't agree with them.
Yeah. I'm looking here at Immanuel Kant's list, the one that you provide in the book of the 10 things, and I'm assuming that it is in, as you say, that it is in, as you go down the list, the severity of the thing increases. So obviously, yes, the thing that's next to being gay is committing suicide. So obviously, he thinks it's worse to be gay than to kill yourself, which seems a little odd.
Yes, it does as well. But here as well, you know, a terrific example. We are not supposed to kill ourselves until quite recently. If you killed yourself and you were Roman Catholic, you couldn't be buried in a church cemetery. In some branches of Judaism, it was much the same thing as well. That's to say, killing yourself was something that you were simply not allowed to do. And here as well, I'm sorry for cutting in on you, but you know, mm-hmm. all we have to do is think about Oregon and the death with dignity movement. I think Americans are also quite perplexed over this question of why we can't kill ourselves if we want to, particularly if our medical prognosis is dire. That's to say, there's absolutely no expectation that we will ever recover and that the next couple weeks or months of our lives will be extraordinarily painful.
To spring off from the subtitle of the book, The Lure of Self-Harm, it seems that in this particular case where we're talking about why does people do things bad for them, the opposite, as you lay out some of the arguments and the thinking, the opposite of self-harm is not self-good, it's self-control. And I think that it's very interesting that we have this idea that the idea is that somehow we have impulses, we have natural impulses that are bad for us. And so what we're really talking about in here is indeed not so much doing what's right as it is refraining from doing what's wrong. And that's something that's a mark of character, the degree to which you can do that.
Right. very big question, very complicated philosophically, but we all know from the time that we start school that we are to keep quiet when the teacher is speaking. We're not to hit, punch, or slap other people. We're not to throw things in the classroom, etc., etc. We grow up, move through college, we start jobs. In the office, we know better than to throw hot coffee on people whom we dislike or slander people whom we hope will get fired, etc., etc. We all know that in order to move forward in the world, we really do have to keep in check certain desires that lurk deep within us. Fine, but there's a very strong current that's driven Americans from the very beginning, and that is individualism. It is don't fence me in. It is born to be wild. It's Peter Fonda on that motorcycle off on the California freeway. It's throwing off the restraints of other people, other cultures, other governments, and damn it, becoming who we really are and seizing the day and living for ourselves. And so Americans in particular, although to a certain extent anyone living in a free country, lives with this regular struggle to get by in the world, to succeed, and to be who you really, truly are. You may be, say, for example, someone who really really should have a split tongue, or you may be someone who really doesn't care and smokes cigarettes anyway, or rides a bicycle without a helmet, or drives a car without a seatbelt. Here in Virginia, you can be fined if you're caught driving in a car without a seatbelt, but you may say, hey, it's my life. I feel constrained when I'm in my convertible BMW, and thank you very much, but I don't want to wear a seatbelt. And so there is this strong presumption, I think, throughout the West, that good people will control themselves and they will do as they're told. That's fine, but we have to balance that against our continual struggle to become who we are and find ourselves. You know, Oprah Winfrey is constantly talking about this, and Dr. Phil. I mean, we are a self-help, self-improvement culture. We live enthralled with this romantic notion that there's some true self lurking deep within us. And in order to find it, we're going to have to raise a little hell. And so that's really where the book begins. How are we going to negotiate this struggle to get promoted at work and find that thrill that defines us, jumping out of an airplane with a parachute or jumping off a bridge with a bungee cord? How are we going to be responsible citizens and truly ourselves?
Well, that, I guess that gets us into the heart of the explanation. And I have a caller here and I want to get right to, but just to round out this point, it gets us into the heart of the explanation, I think, because at one point in the book, you thoughtfully provide a chart looking at some of the various kinds of self-harm, and also that you say, obviously, these are not exhaustive. There are others, but generally they fall into three broad categories. Stupidity, which would include something like smoking a cigarette while you're putting gasoline in your car.
Yes.
Self-indulgence, which would include something, like bungee jumping, for example. Maybe we could use that one. Right. Or self-sabotage, which would include something like, starting to use heroin. We would look at all of those things and say that they are harmful and not particularly smart. And then if we look at this question, all right, what is this really all about? It seems that the heart of your argument is that sometimes what looks to us in another person as being behavior that is not smart and is potentially self-harmful, that for them, even though there are a lot of different things, and obviously, again, something like if you're terminally ill and deciding that you would want to end your life at the point where you make the choice, that there's a lot of difference between that and deciding you want to split your tongue. But at the end of the day, what it is about is about controlling your own body, your right. own future, making your own choices. It really is a statement of asserting your individuality and your autonomy. That really what it's about. And it can look stupid and ill-advised to us, and we could say, well, we would never do it. But there may be indeed things that we would do the motivation, it would be a different act, but the motivation would be the same. And you're suggesting that this is a very fundamental human kind of impulse.
Yes, yes. Well put. You've done a good job of summarizing the book.
Well, with that, we'll bring in this caller here. We have someone listening in Champaign on line number one. Hello.
Yes, I have, you know, a confused question to ask, but your guest asked the question, why can't we kill ourselves? But of course we can. It's society that says that we can't or that we shouldn't. Or I think he asked, why do we do or engage in self-destructive behavior? And I guess I'm thinking of things like alcoholism and, you know, methamphetamine addiction. I just heard a story about that in South Dakota, and it's kind of like, wow, you know, it's highly addictive. It, you know, why do people do this? And it seems that, you know, there's a short-term kind of gratification, whether it's going along socially with other people or some physical thing that one gets out of it. And then there's the question of, you know, does one consider one's long-term welfare, and is a 17-year-old capable of, you know, knowing about, having a rational understanding of addiction, and making a rational decision in the face of peer pressure. But anyway, so it seems like there are, you know, biological reasons why one might become an addict, and then there may be social reasons why one is prone to engage in this behavior. And, well, I guess, you know, there are, you know, one can rationally understand addiction, and then one can have an irrational desire for individualization or revolt or identity formation or something like that. And I'm just wondering how you look at this in relation to some theory of evolution, which may be more biological, and you're looking more at the social, that of, you know, a notion that, you know, that people would, you know, look after their own good, or there would be some survival instinct or survival of the fittest. So how do you, you know, bring it in with any notion of, you know, species?
Okay. A couple of good points. You led off with this idea with which I wholeheartedly agree that sometimes what our teachers and rabbis and priests and parole officers tell us is bad for us really is bad for us. Addictions figure prominently in the book, and addictions are a real problem. If you think of the frat house blowout, if you think of carnival, you know, Mardi Gras, if you think of, if you will, statistically, the bulk of Americans who can take a drink or two or three and then stop, you see a very different category than people who cannot stop, that's to say the addicted. What I focus on is the class of people that can lose control on a Friday or Saturday night and then get it back the following morning. And I distinguish them from people who can't get their self-control back. So I focus on something I call raving, taking the word from these dances that became so popular in the late 80s and the 90s. 20-somethings and 19-year-olds would flock to them. And in these parties, you would sort of plan to lose control, and then you would get it back, much in the way that I think people sometimes do on American TV talk shows. So you're absolutely right. Addiction is a real problem, and I don't think that addiction can or should be fun. Some people might insist that it is for a while, but I think that almost all addicts will tell you that it's really not fun. It's very painful. What I focus on in the book is fun way of losing self-control temporarily. So you're absolutely right. When it comes to evolution, it is puzzling, isn't it? My focus is, as you guess, is really on the social side. When it comes to evolution, it's very hard to understand why we would do things that are bad for us, why we would endanger ourselves. Crystal methamphetamine, say, for example, this is an example you gave, is highly addictive and very dangerous. It destroys people's lives. Even if it doesn't actually kill them, it leads them to bottom out. You will lose your job, you will lose your friends, you will lose your bank account, etc., etc. You will find yourself deeply, deeply unhappy. Why, from a biological point of view, would we do this? It's very hard to say. Very, very hard to say. It may be that some people have genes that drive them to end their lives, and that this function, this phenomenon is a way of the gene pool sort of cleansing itself of undesirable elements. I don't really take a position on that, but I acknowledge, as I think you are, that this is really very puzzling why we would do this. You know, if you carry your question to its logical end, why would we do anything that's really any fun at all? I mean, apart from staying home on a Saturday night, locked up in your room doing a crossword puzzle, you know, why would you do anything that's fun? Why would you go on a Ferris wheel? Why would you speed? Even if there's no one on the highway, you're in the Arizona or Nevada desert and there's no one around and you know that you're not supposed to go faster than 65 miles an hour, but you really want to break 100, and so you do it. Why would we take any chances like that? It must be that apart from this biological component, we human beings have a very important psychological component that cries out for, demands satisfaction, and that's where the trouble begins.
Well, I suppose there is a, you know, risk takers also can survive or succeed or get ahead more than those who don't take risks. I guess it depends on what risk they take. Thrill seekers, maybe. Maybe, whatever, better soldiers, better at killing people.
And that's a very important function in any modern culture. You're absolutely right. They might be better athletes as well. They might be better equipped to step up to the starting blocks at the Olympics. You're absolutely right.
But at the same time, I mean, every 17-year-old or 14-year-old or 16-year-old is going to believe that I'm just doing this for fun and it's only a part-time thing and it's, I'm going to be able to control this. Whereas I guess parents are saying, well, if kids are splitting their tongues, then they're going to do something else bad or this is satanic or whatever, it's not natural. So then there's the question of the risk to society and how society response to them. I guess, you know, addiction obviously is very costly to the healthcare system or to, you know, the educational system or to, you know, lots of systems in the society. So I guess society has interests, you know, in people not being addicted, whether they have interests in, it doesn't seem that society has an interest in keeping people from killing themselves. It seems like it's going to have to be something we're going to have to work out in the next 30 years when the healthcare system goes to hell. You know, where, how are we going to organize euthanasia? I think it's going to have to take place. But on that point, I'll leave it to the rest of the callers. Thanks a lot.
All right. Well,
okay.
Thanks.
If I could just respond to that final point.
Yeah.
I'll say that I was myself very interested to find in Kant opposition to the point that the caller just so articulated so thoughtfully. Kant believes that, in fact, humanity does have a compelling moral interest in preventing people from killing themselves. Kant believes that human beings are extraordinary creatures made by God above the animal kingdom. Because human beings possess reason, they are very, very special. And he thinks of humanity as a kind of elite club. We might think of, I don't know, past presidents of the United States or University of Illinois alumni. I don't know. But this club has to stick together. And if any one of them does something disgraceful, that disgrace will tarnish, will taint the rest of the club. And so Kant believes strongly and argues at length that we don't really belong to ourselves. We belong to God, and we have an obligation to all the people around us to honor them. If we split our tongues, if we kill ourselves, if we engage in illicit sexual activity, we disgrace the rest of humanity. And therefore, we harm not only ourselves, but we harm others as well. Masturbation would be a good example here as well. Even though you may think that you're completely alone when you masturbate, Kant would say, although he doesn't take up this explicitly, though I'm convinced he would agree, when you do this, you disgrace the rest of humanity. You bring everyone else down. So although I agree that the caller has a very thoughtful point, clearly, on point with regard to contemporary American culture, Kant, if he were around today, would say that no, in point of fact, your body does not belong to you, and humanity does have a compelling moral interest to prevent you from taking your own life or perhaps having an abortion, because your body belongs to other human beings as much as it belongs to you.
I think it's interesting in talking the way that you talk about Kant in the book, that in as much as we believe that now in the modern world we value autonomy and individualism, and that we particularly value those things here in the United States, the
yes.
kind of notion that you've just articulated is still very potent. And in fact, I think in the book that you say, in terms of the way we think about morality and correct behavior, that Kant has more influence than any other source save the Bible in how it is that we think about that very these very matters.
I think that's right. Your listeners may very well disagree with me. You may disagree with me. But I do think that many, many Americans, without realizing it, agree with Kant. Legal scholars will tell you that Kant's moral thinking has had an enormous influence on the laws of our country. I'm not a legal scholar, so I won't pretend to have any authority there. But I do think that many Americans, on some level, really do agree with Kant, that there's something to this idea that we humans have to stick together, and that when we harm ourselves, we sort of harm the whole club. That said, there's surely many, many other people who disagree or who would say that Kant's theory doesn't really work out in contemporary America. Kant really had no idea what euthanasia was. He didn't live in a culture in which biotechnology could keep people alive on ventilators, for example, for many, many years, or a culture in which stem cell research was possible, etc., etc. So the world has changed enormously in the two centuries since Kant died. And what I try to do in the book is figure out to what extent Kant's rules, which he considered eternal, really apply to contemporary Western culture.
Our guest is John Portman. He is Assistant Professor of Religious Studies at University of Virginia, author of the book When Bad Things Happen to Other People, which is about why it is often we take pleasure in the misfortune of others. His most recent is Bad for Us, The Lure of Self-Harm, exploring this question of why it is that people often do things that clearly are against their best interest. It's published by the Beacon Press. We have another caller to bring into the conversation here on our toll-free line, line 4, in Charleston. Hello.
Yes, perhaps your guest can address power, money, social conformity, and the dialectic therein contained. I'll ring off and listen. Thank you.
Well, is the question clear?
Yes, yes. Power is very much to the point of the book. Although even in America, arguably the most free country in the world, we think that we're free. We know that in many regards, we're not. We, as I mentioned earlier, can land ourselves in trouble if we're caught driving without a seatbelt. At least you can in Virginia. I'm not quite sure what it's like in each of the other states. But that's one thing that you can't do. Another thing that you can't do, surprisingly enough, is burn down your own house. There are things that you can't do for a variety of reasons that indicate that a government has control over you. There are things that Jews may not do to themselves, or Catholics may not do to themselves, or Muslims may not do to themselves. A government, a religion, any kind of community, the parent-teacher organization or the local country club, may exercise power over you, let's just say specifically over your behavior. And so we all live in America with a certain amount of individual power that sometimes conflicts with group power around us. And personally, I just don't think there's any way out of this. Learn to live with the fact that our government has and always will have certain powers over us. And that's not such a bad thing, because if that government didn't have power over us, there would probably be more rapes and murders and thefts and so forth. So that's my position. You probably can't do much better than the society that we're, if you will, stuck with now, although in lots of very specific areas, such as same-sex marriage or perhaps abortion, we do find divisive, very interesting, very philosophically compelling arguments about the extent to which a government should have power over us in our private lives.
Let's go to another caller here. Is a listener is in Belgium, Illinois, line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
with your discussion here, I'm listening to what society prohibits us to do to ourselves, but yet I don't see where your argument is going along when we consider the aspect of what we allow industry to do to our environment, which in effect kills us, or the increasing population that puts more and more of a burden on our environment, which tends to shorten our situations.
Yes, that would be a very interesting follow-up to this book. This book is really focused on individuals, and certainly corporations can harm individuals, no question about that. And individuals, perhaps in a corporation, perhaps not, can harm the environment, and that pollution can come back to harm us and our children. Yes, you're absolutely right. But my focus is really on what we, acting more or less on our own, can or cannot do to ourselves. This question of
aren't we essentially doing it to ourselves? I mean, we are the corporations. We are the entities that consume and consume and consume and pollute. It is us. How would Canada handle that?
Yes, yes. And the example of overpopulation is also very interesting. Right. These questions raise what philosophers call intergenerational conflict. If, say, for example, this current generation drives up the national debt to a point that, you know, our children could never work their way out of it, then we have, in some real sense, harmed our children. The same is certainly true of pollution and harming the environment. The question of whether we Americans, say, for example, harm ourselves by indulging in so much consumerism, which I think is fair. I think we do that. Is interesting. It's not straightforwardly clear how we harm ourselves when we do this. If we have the money to pay the Visa bill at the end of every month, then we're not straightforwardly harming ourselves. If we don't, then we are by overextending ourselves financially. I guess it's not entirely clear to me how we, as a very, very consumerist society, harm ourselves, unless you mean that we're taking more food or more oil than is really due us, and by hogging all of this food and oil, we're harming the rest of the world. It's not immediately clear to me.
No, sir. The point I'm saying is that whenever you consume an item, you produce more carbon dioxide. Pollute your environment,
right,
no matter what you know, whatever, whoever it goes to. If there's more and more people, whether you're in India or you're in America, it doesn't really much matter. More and more consumption hurts the whole.
Right. A lot to be said about this. Interestingly enough, the idea that overpopulation really works against our self-interest is, I think, pretty straightforward and really very compelling. If you focus on, say, for example, Roman Catholics, though, roughly 67 million of them in America, the largest church in America, there is a very clear rule against artificial birth control. And so this idea that you're helping humanity by keeping down the number of children you have stands in conflict with the expectation under which Roman Catholics live, that they will swear off artificial birth control and welcome as many children as God sends their way. So here as well, with reference to the previous caller, we see another example of how we live in certain power structures in America. If you're not Roman Catholic, then this isn't necessarily a problem for you at all. And as we know from numerous polls, most Roman Catholics don't abide by this rule either. But you can at least see how conflict enters. I mean, yes, the caller has a good point. Overpopulation works against our self-interest, certainly against the interest we have in the welfare of our children, having enough food and living in a clean environment. However, it's not straightforwardly the case that everyone could work against overpopulation. Roman Catholics, to take just one example, would say, well, there's a problem here, and we're going to let God take care of the problem that gels or comes to be in 20 years when the world is overpopulated and we have to worry about even worse pollution than we have today.
I'm going to jump in. I hope the caller will forgive me, because I have some other folks I want to bring in it. And I think that while the questions that he's raising are perfectly legitimate, I think they're slightly off the topic, in the sense that I think what he's talking about is how actions we might take as individuals perhaps harm the collective. It's not so much the kind of focus that we've been talking about, and that is actions that individuals take that harm themselves directly. It's a real one-on-one. It's sort of the victimless crime, I think, is what it is you're talking about.
Yes.
And to get one other point that you touched on earlier that I think you're also talking about in the book, and that is that if we say that that human beings are this interesting balance of impulses. On the one hand, you could make the argument that the reason that humans have been successful as a species is that their willingness to be a member of the group and kind of go along. And at the same time, we also may have a little bit of an impulse now and then to say, yes, but I'm different from these other people. So mm-hmm. a little bit of acting out might be natural. And you make the argument, I think, in the book that actually maybe a little bit of acting out in a controlled way might also be healthy in the sense that it's a kind of a vaccination against the impulse to do even more. And that maybe that's not so every once in a while to let yourself go in a way that's has boundaries is maybe not such a bad thing.
Yes. You've summed up the point very well. And again, just to show that even this summary, which is really very clear and very good, is problematic. You might think of, say, for example, young girls between the ages of, say, 12 and 18, 12 and 22 demographically, will go to their rooms and they will cut themselves with a razor, perhaps burn themselves. And psychiatrists are very interested in this phenomenon, which seems to be growing in America. You know, on the one hand, they're just sort of letting off some steam, they might say. But on the other hand, this particular example, and there are others, of how we act out, of how we let off some steam, you know, show our wild side, is problematic and does make other people worry about us, probably quite legitimately. But again, it raises the question of who are we to say? Who am I to tell you what you can or can't do with yourself?
Next, let's talk with someone in Indiana, Terre Haute, line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, you're talking about decisions that people make that are go against their own welfare, and I think you're talking about a lot of physical harm that they're doing to themselves. What I was wondering about was if you could comment on people who are in positions of power, like chairmen, CEOs of big corporations, who, for reasons apparently only known to them, they're living a very good life, they have plenty of money, and then they commit a crime to get more money when they really don't need it. Or in the situation of, I can't remember her name, the teacher out on the West Coast who ruined her life and the lives of her family by carrying on an affair with that with the young boy.
Right. Well, very difficult questions, questions that interest me. I have to say up front that I'm not a psychiatrist. And so what I can do is puzzle over the answer with you, but I can't provide you with a definitive psychiatric explanation. We humans seem to crave adventure. We go to adventure parks and we take the roller coaster. We take these rides that terrify us, rides that if they malfunction could easily kill us. We're not really harming our bodies, but we are doing something to ourselves psychically, or if you will, spiritually, that might be considered worrisome. This woman who carried on an affair with the boy, was he 13 or 14 when he first...
I think he was 13, yeah.
13, right. And they had an affair and she became pregnant. And if I'm not mistaken, once she was released from prison, she went back to him and he sired yet another child. It's difficult to say what she was doing. If I'm not mistaken, she said that she was pursuing true love, which is something all of us want. Why was she doing it in such a dangerous way? Why did she risk everything she had in order to get that true love? That's a very, very difficult question. It's a fascinating question. We might juxtapose that question with the problems facing Governor McGreevy in New Jersey. Mm-hmm. Presumably, Governor McGreevy was pursuing true love as well. I think there are plenty of men in America, certainly in Europe, who keep mistresses in part because of the thrill. Governor McGreevy, I think, is really on the cusp of a generation that didn't have the option of living a gay life publicly. Governor McGreevy, a Roman Catholic, was in two heterosexual marriages, and although he hasn't said this, I imagine that he would say that true love in a traditional way was never an option for him, and so he had to do something on the sly, if you will, something stealthily. And plenty of Americans might say, well, you no longer have to live that way, and we could argue at great length whether that's true. But why did Governor McGreevy do something that was so very, very, very bad for him? He's lost a lot. Why did he do that? Maybe for true love. Maybe love is such a special and wonderful thing that we are willing to risk absolutely everything in our lives, our wives, our husbands, our children, our reputation, our bank accounts, in order to get it. That's a very old idea. It was an idea that was quite familiar to the ancient Greeks. I don't know, caller, what do you think? Love
and money.
Greed, because you actually brought up the corporate CEOs who were doing something, I think, a little different. Greed is bad, even though in order to succeed in corporate America, you have to be hungry. You've always got to want more money, another deal, and so forth. And I don't think anyone would argue that those corporate CEOs went way too far. So, that's an interesting question. What do you think of this idea that maybe the corporate CEOs were taking these chances and acting out of greed in order to satisfy the demands of, you know, a woman that they truly loved? Does that sound at all compelling to you?
Well, it certainly makes sense. What I don't understand is, possibly because I'm not in that position, how you could want more than what you've already got when you're living such a comfortable life to start with.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's a very good question, and a question that I walk around again and again in a book. When we look at other people and ask them, why would you ever want that? Why would you do that? Why would you jump out of an airplane with a parachute or use a bungee cord, or Princess Diana would hurl herself down staircases when Prince Charles had said something unpleasant to her or perhaps done worse? I share your puzzlement, looking at other people on hunger strikes or what have you, and asking, why would you do that? Why would you go that far? And I can't really give an answer there. All I can do is point to these examples and say, this is a really interesting aspect of what it means to be human. Coming to a point where you...
Is the mindset the same that, for instance, the physical harm, the risk of physical harm, and the risk of your entire social life being completely ruined?
Good question. I can't say for sure, but I think that there are real similarities. I do. And I think that most people, I have no clinical proof here, but I think that most people would be more willing to risk their reputation than their bodies.
I'm going to jump here. Again, I really appreciate the questions the caller is asking, because I think they're really interesting. I think you said earlier that you weren't a psychiatrist or weren't a psychologist, and I am not either, but I'm willing to advance a kind of psychological explanation that goes back to this idea that what we're talking about here is an extreme sort of statement about individuality, is that when you get in a situation like that, it's not about the money anymore. What it's about is an individual saying to themselves, there are rules, but they're for other people. They're not for me, because I'm not one of them. They're the crowd. They're the little rules are for little people. Well,
right. Or
I'm
the
not.
Famous Leona Helmsley line. Only little people pay taxes.
Exactly.
I shouldn't be expecting to pay taxes. Right?
So it's a way of the person saying, there is everybody else, and then there's me. The rules are for them, but there's a special set that apply to me, and that's how it is. You can get into a situation. I don't want to name any names, but you could have someone who had a big company and was a famous media celebrity and was willing to risk everything to save $40,000. That doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense unless you look at it through that other kind of lens that says, there's everybody else and then there's me.
Mm-hmm. And I think that American culture, to a large extent, encourages ambitiousness. I'm not saying that American culture encourages us to think that we don't have to play by the rules, not at all. But I think that American culture really encourages people to be entrepreneurs and experiment and be creative and you know, run faster than other people or make more money than other people or be the early bird and get the worm first, et cetera, et cetera. I think that there is this kind of sort of audacity to American culture, which can be quite good, but can also be dangerous.
We'll see if we can get one or two more callers. The next in line is in southeastern Illinois, line one. Hello.
Yeah, I've got a number of things that I don't know how much they pertain to your thing. On the business of why does somebody want more, you reach a point where, as the saying goes, money is just a way of keeping score. You're in a competition, and it's just a way of keeping score. The money as such doesn't mean that much. You spoke of birth control. It isn't Roman Catholics. They're not the only one that are against any form of birth control, but the... Have you noticed that the people who are so hard against birth control strive very hard for death control, although both of them is the thwarting of the will of God? I mean, God has been trying to take the Pope for years now, and he's hanging on by his fingernails. and that is death control. We all think death control is a wonderful thing, although that's as much a thwarting of God's will as birth control is.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, every new thing, every new form of death control we grab onto with enthusiasm.
Yes.
When I was very young, I tried to read some Kant or Kant, and I was in above my head, and I read some of the things. Didn't he have what he called moral imperatives?
Yes.
Okay.
Imperative.
Well, one of his moral imperatives was that we should not do anything that everyone couldn't do.
Exactly.
It would be bad if we should not do anything that would be bad for everyone if everybody did the same thing.
Right.
And that's foolishness. I mean, you take somebody who lived probably the best life that we, you know, the example of life, Jesus of Nazareth. Where would society be if everybody wandered about the countryside preaching? There is nothing that the whole of society depends on people doing different things.
We have just about a minute left, I'm sorry to say. I'm going to give John Portman a chance to say something as a way of wrapping things up. And I don't know if you want to respond to the last point, if we even have time to do that.
Sure. Actually, the first point I think is actually even more important.
Mm-hmm.
We do live in a very religious culture here in America. And we haven't talked about, at least not yet, the point that the caller brings up at the beginning. And that is to say that religious people will tell you that you can do something bad for you spiritually. You can decrease the chances that you will make it to heaven. You can do something so bad that you will, in God's eyes, damn yourself for eternity. And so there is a very important spiritual dimension to this question of what is bad for us. And the caller raises attention to that aspect of the whole topic very usefully at the beginning of his comments.
Well, we will have to leave it at that with the suggestion that if folks want to explore further the ideas we've been talking about, look for the book Bad for Us, The Lure of Self-Harm by our guest John Portman. It's published by the Beacon Press. John Portman is assistant professor of religious studies at the University of Virginia. We want to say, Professor Portman, thank you very much for talking with us.
The pleasure's all mine. Thank you.
Also, we want to say thanks to the folks at the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities for helping us out and providing the high-quality connection with this morning's guest.